Okay, guys. Thanks, everyone, for coming. As you'll see from my podium here, I have a theme for tonight, and it's brotherly love. All right, so we're all going to be nice and respectful to each other and have a conversation here and exhibit the principles of brotherly love. We do have Lance and Greg are down in the Columbia, so they're listening in on the phone for us. And if they have any questions or anything they want to bring forth, they're just going to text Barb so she can read them off for us. So, as always, I want to start off the meeting by just saying thank you for coming. This is a meeting of the Will of the Bay Samit Advisory Group. We're here to talk about the comprehensive review process. So, we get paid to be here, you do not. So, we appreciate that. We appreciate you guys taking time out of your busy schedules, thank you all, to come here and talk about fisheries with us. So, thank you. I see we have a few new faces in the room that I haven't seen before, although I've spoken to the gentleman before on the phone, and I want to give an update for the advisory group as well. So, first, I'll do the update. Jessica Hellesley was appointed an advisor in her role as director of the Coastal Salmon Partnership to represent conservation stakeholders here on the advisory group. About middle of last year, she took a position as the director of the Wild Salmon Center. And unfortunately, her duties and responsibilities are not overlapping well with what we're doing here. And she expressed to me late last week that she just wasn't going to be able to continue. And so we had to start a process. She resigned and nominated her replacement at the Coastal Salmon Partnership, Mara Zimmerman, Dr. Mara Zimmerman, with as her replacement. I was supportive of that, and the director signed off on it, so Mara will be filling that spot from here forward. She has been given everything that you folks have been given since we started these meetings late last year. Or early part of last year. So I think what I'd like to do real quick is just kind of go around the room and do an introductions and kind of why we're here, who we're representing, just so we can all make sure we're reacquainted with each other. I'm Chad Herring. I'm the South Coast Fishery Policy Lead, so I manage commercial and recreational fisheries for Willapa Bay, Grays Harbor, and up to the Queets watershed. That's what I do.
Hi, David Peterson, work for the Media Study, the District 5 for
Francis Estalila, representing Recreation and Conservation Committee from the get-go.
Steve Burns, board.
Mara Zimmerman.
Tim Hamilton, Conservation.
I'm Ross Barkhurst, Conservation and Recreational Fishing. And I'm the leader of Citizens Group, called Willapa Bay Ecosystem Review Team.
For Lisa Dugan, I am a freshwater recreational fisher advocate. I'm passionate about trying to make sure that after fish allocation that there's still enough fish in the gravel for a meaningful recreational fishery.
I'm Norm Reinhart. Recreational advocate for saltwater.
Bob Rick, I'm the president of Willapa Bay Wildlife Association and also the manager for Willapa Bay RPG.
Andy Mindy, commercial advisor.
Chad Collins, the commercial advisor.
Barbara Collins from the area by Willapa Bay.
Over there, you, Mike.
Mike Thornton, manager of the Pacific Grays Harbor Conservation District.
Gentlemen there in the back.
I'm Bart Popko, just a kind of sport fisherman. I'm hoping that at some point in time we can get our act together and get some real fishing here so that both the sportsmen and the commercial fishermen can have a good time and make money.
What was your first name again?
Clark.
What's that?
Clark, like Silverman.
Clark. Okay, Clark. Thank you for coming, Clark.
John, yeah,
Mr. Superman.
Could you guys make sure you sign up, please?
Yeah, anybody who hasn't signed in, could you please sign into the sheet? We need to make sure we get an accurate count of people who were here.
Alan Hollingsworth, the Director of Commercial Fisheries and Sport.
You're elected, Will Farley, get signed.
Dan Reed, go on.
Arnold. I think I'll be able to cover your traffic and stuff. Dale Peters.
Arnold, George.
We also have many attention.
Okay. And just for your information, Laura, we have three other advisors who aren't here tonight. Lance Gray and Greg McMillan are commercial advisors. They're down on the Columbia waiting for that opener tonight, so they're listening on the phone. And the last advisor that is not here tonight is Jim Sace. He is the director of the Pacific County Economic Development Council. Last I heard. Is he still? They've moved a few of them around. So in your packets for advisors tonight, since we did have that change, I just wanted to update this for you guys. I have put a new roster, Willapa Bay roster, in your guys' books that has the contact information. Keep in mind, we decided as a group that it was okay to share our phone numbers within the group, but we will not share those outside of the group. Any correspondence from the public to advisors should be done through email. Don't want to start giving out personal information as much as possible. So, okay. So, let's see. The next thing on our agenda that I wanted to talk about tonight is the comprehensive review timeline. So, that'll be the handout, the third page in the packets tonight. It's kind of blue and white thing here. So this is what we've been doing, working through the comprehensive review. I went in front of Fish and Wildlife Fish Committee at the June meeting, and they asked of me to provide a schedule for moving forward if any change, once we complete the comprehensive review, if the commission decides additional analyses or other things want to be done after that point in time, they wanted me to put together a process and timeline to make sure that we had all our ducks in a row and everything in place in terms of a process for how we will approach 2020 north of Falcon. I didn't like how that went last year. It didn't go well. We were in the middle of wondering, you know, having meetings, not sure what our objectives were, what our management criteria was for that coming year. So don't want to replicate that process. Didn't think that went very well. So we have outlined that here. That's at the bottom, and I'll just kind of run through from the top. So had our first public workshop in January 23rd of 2018. We had some Willapa Bay Advisory Group meetings in the fall, September, October. Went to Fish Committee in November, looking at this proposed process. Then went in front of the whole the Fish and Wildlife Commission, April 1st. That was where we got our guidance for 2019 fisheries. June 13th, I went back in front of Fish Commission, we had a draft table of contents for the comprehensive review and also these scheduling things that I just spoke about that was done at that meeting. And here we are tonight, August 14th, taking feedback from the advisors and discussing the analyses that we've completed so far today. So that'll be upcoming here after we finish this little portion. What I really wanted to talk about mostly in this section of the agenda is the commission wanted us to have regular check-ins with the Willapa Bay Advisory Group as we move forward. So what we have is, in terms of a deadline for the final comprehensive review, will be mid-October. We want to have that report finalized at least internally, and then we will go to the commission with it at that commission meeting in October to seek their approval of the comprehensive review. So one of the things that we discussed was sending out sections of the report as we finish them, or at least get them to their first draft before they've gone through editing and make sure we get that out to the commission and we get that out to the advisors so they can review it, and then we can have kind of these monthly check-ins in September and October to discuss that, take feedback to inform that October presentation. For me, I need to get what you all think and coalesce and make sure I tell the commission about what your thoughts are. So that's my task for October. So I wanted to just talk with you guys about how that might work best. September and October are kind of difficult months in terms of fisheries. October is going to be really tough. We're going to end up doing a 6 o'clock down here, and chances are there's going to be a fishery happening. It's going to be a little problematic for us. It's going to be a little bit of a tough lift, but I want to make sure that people first want to get together and discuss this, or would it be better just to send out the sections and that you guys could provide us your written feedback via email or that way? So I'm willing to take some comments on that if you get.
Matt, you're talking about September.
Yeah.
Was that during the week, that meeting?
Yeah, that's one thing.
The Saturday meeting.
We could do that.
That way we'll be closed on Saturday.
Okay. That's one thought we had. Yeah. If that's what everybody likes, if they're okay with that. Tim?
I haven't heard I'd do that. Because you have a habit of not circulating emails and sponsors to go around, and I would prefer to see the comments in front of us.
Okay.
I'd like to have the meeting then be easier for me.
Okay. Andy?
You can have a meeting whenever you want, just have it on a phone call.
Okay. Yeah, we will always, you know, we'll try and work something out. It's difficult here because we don't have a conference line, but, you know, I don't know if Andy or Andy, Lance and Greg are having a hard time if they're able to follow us or hear us.
If you put the material out before we get there, they're on a phone conference, pick your gate, everybody will be on the phone.
Okay. So that would work for September and October. Okay. All right, well then I think, is there any other advisory comments on this? I'm not seeing any. Okay. I think what we'll go ahead and do is Barb and I will look at a kind of a range of dates and maybe send out a doodle pool again, and we can just make a, you know, consensus rule. Tim?
You mentioned that this has gone out to the commission. I must have missed this. What have you got to take? We hadn't seen this last part of the presentation, had we?
No, you hadn't seen the presentation. No.
You've seen this abundance.
Yeah, I sent that out on Friday. Damon just finished the presentation on the way down here, so it'll be. I would have sent that too. Yeah, if I would have had it.
Did you send this to the commission?
The commission hasn't seen the presentation. The commission saw the same thing you did.
This.
That off. That's it. Yeah. The commission hasn't seen the presentation. Yeah. No, we didn't send a draft of that out yet. Well, like you said, we just got it done prior to this meeting. As always, anything I get done that we're going to talk about in the meetings, if I have it, I'll send it out ahead of time. I got no problem doing that. I just can't guarantee I could do that every time. So, okay. All right. I think that settles that. Sounds like I'll send out a doodle poll. We'll pick some dates and consensus will rule. All right. So, next on my agenda was the staff presentation. And we're way ahead of schedule. Okay. So before we get into that, let's just talk about this for a second. Damon's got about a 15-20 minute presentation that he'll run through. We'll allow some question and answers, and we'll have some discussion around that. And then I also included, if we wanted to talk about any in-season stuff, we also have the first, Barb sent out an email this afternoon that has a recreational update for stat week 32, sorry, my eyes are terrible. For 32, so we can discuss that in any detail if folks would like, if we have time left. And always, as always, we will leave the last 15-20 minutes for the public to be able to speak onto the record. So that's how we'll move forward, and without any further ado, Mr. Peterson.
Okay. Well, there will be some ado, I guess, until we wait for this thing to boot up.
Sure.
Did everybody get a copy of my email from Friday? Everybody was able to see the document. Nobody had any issues. Printed out anything like that. Looking at it. Okay. I just want to make sure you guys all got it. So. There was a problem, we could make sure and get that resolved.
Still not heard of. Hey! No, I'm trying to shrink it a little. The leg is gone. There it goes.
There we are. That's perfect.
That's perfect.
Just get all right.
That's right. I can do that. Yeah, yeah. Well, all right, guys. So, one of the things we wanted to talk to y'all today about was essentially one of the primary chapters of the policy review, specifically focusing on abundance of salmon within Willow Bay as a function of the policy 3622. And so just get into a little bit of background. Pacific salmon are in trouble. I think this audience, everybody knows that, right? But some of the evidence we use to discern whether Pacific salmon are, whether organisms are in trouble is looking at distribution. Shifts, large-scale shifts in distribution have been associated with salmon in part because of complete and incomplete barriers. In addition, salmon are experiencing habitat degradation, not only in the freshwater systems for spawning habitat and juvenile rearing, but also in the saltwater systems, too. And then in addition, on top of all of this, salmon are having trouble in terms of exploitation and hatchery practices as well. So those are sort of some added pressures. I'm just sort of going through that a little quickly because I know most of you already know this. And so since I'm a little new to these systems, these Pacific Northwestern systems, you know, you hear about how these fish are in trouble. And so one of the things that I sort of first start to think about, well, is what were the historic run sizes pre-settlement, right? That's sort of where my mind goes. What are the run sizes supposed to be classically? And there are some studies that have tried to track this down. So if you look at Chapman et al. In 1986, he was among the first to try this. I say among, this is the earliest I could find. And if anybody has some research before this, I'd love to see it. Fill out the rest of the table here. And essentially what they said, using anthropological data, so that's knowledge about what the population sizes were for Native American tribes, combined with how many salmon they typically eat, coupled with, you know, extrapolating to the total run sizes and how much they typically exploited those run sizes, he came up with a number that suggested that we're only about at 44% by and large of what we used to be in terms of our classical run sizes. And that seems like, well, so, you know, about every one fish you see in the water, you could actually picture another one in there, right? But when we start getting to more and more modern studies, like Gresh et al. And Meetings et al., in 2005, they used some of these cannery data, and it suggests that we're actually only at 3% in some cases of our classical run sizes. Obviously, these are, you know, dependent upon the areas that we're talking about. For the, you know, in large part, these are focused around the Columbia River, and I limited the research to just the lower 48 United States. And so, essentially, you know, there's no question that Pacific salmon are having a rough time. Out here in Willapa Bay, explicitly, though, when you start to think about, even though we don't have classical run sizes, we've got some indicators, essentially, about how the populations are doing here. And so, here, if you take a look at this chart over here, it goes back to 1980. What we're showing is Willapa Bay wild Chinook spawner escapement on the Y, and then on the X is all of the years of our estimated escapement. The black line is supposed to be our calculated escapement goal, and while those are they're often contested, it does represent a measuring stick by which we can ask whether we're doing okay in Willapa Bay. And we're always missing our escapement goal, right? Here you can see, so that stops in 2014. We can fill out the rest of those years over here. We can see the wild Chinook recently has not really made our escapement objectives. So this all sort of established the impetus to develop a policy. This policy, well, you have folks here, and the commission developed the policy C3622. Essentially, it was needed to enhance conservation. There was frustration with harvest allocation and a lack of trust. I highlighted the enhanced conservation in red because that's what I'm going to be addressing here.
The policy goals were essentially to achieve restoration of wild salmon and avoid ESA designation, among other things. And again, the ones that are highlighted in red are what we're going to be talking about today. And then in addition, maintain or enhance economic well-being, partition fishing opportunities, enhance transparency and information sharing. I hope we're doing some of that today, and restore and maintain public trust and support. So it's restored now, right? What the policy did essentially, C3622, functionally what it did was it implemented some harvest control rules, right? So, and what that was intended to do was it was intended to reduce the total number of Chinook that we were taking due to the fishery, and functionally that meant that Chinook were limited, wild Chinook were limited to impacts at 20% Willapa Bay and the Esau Rivers. And so here is a picture. This is a little bit of foreshadowing, right, of some of the graphs that you're going to see. What we've got is total catch of Chinook on the Y, and then we've got drainage on the X. The one that you need to pay attention to right now is just this Willapa Bay graph. The red is always going to be pre-policy, and the blue is going to be policy years or post-enactment of policy. And you can see that what we expected to happen was a reduction in harvest, and indeed, we saw a pretty dramatic reduction in harvest, right?
Green is harvest, and red is what?
The red is pre-policy, the blue is policy. So these are years, right? So these are years before policy, these ones, the red, the blue, or green, whatever you want.
I must be colorblind from that one.
Red, green, but that's fine. So this one and this one, right? So this was harvest before we enacted the policy. Okay. This is harvest after, okay. Right? And you can see this is dramatically smaller, right? That's all you need to take home. Yeah. The policy reduced the overall harvest, right? That's the take home here. And so this sets up a scenario where essentially salmon populations in Willapa Bay appear to be struggling, right? And essentially what we want to do is we want to ask, well, does reducing fishing pressure on Chinook salmon, does that ultimately result in any measurable conservation benefit? Primarily, the things that we measured that would result in concluding whether or not conservation benefit, whether we had a conservation benefit, are essentially wild origin red-based salmon escapement, right? So do we see a response in terms of benefits to wild origin escapement? In addition, we expect to have some hatchery origin escapement increases, and we need to be able to do this while also controlling for differences in run size. That sounds like it's not a big deal, but I'll show you why here in just a second. So our calculation of run size is typically just escapement plus harvest equals run size, right? Not very complicated. We get to escapement by counting reds. I classify that as spawning effort, and then we also get these hatchery rack returns. And while that's simple and straightforward, when you try to control for run size based on this, based on that equation, you get what's called collinearity, right? I know it's a big word, but essentially what that means is that when you try to control for run size, you can't, because run size is a function of escapements. It's actually also a function of harvest, too, right? So controlling for run size, at least based on the way that we calculate, is problematic. So we got to find another way.
Well, guys, let's let him know. Let's try and get.
We can come back. We can come back.
Okay.
Yeah, it's okay. We can come back. Yep.
Yeah, we'll have
And so what we do here then instead is we do this quasi-experimental design. I call it quasi-experimental because it's not. We didn't select the treatment sites at random. It's called a control or before-after control impact design. What we do is we select multiple sites as a treatment group. So our impact sites are going to be Willapa Bay and Chehalis because they both had policy implemented at essentially identical time. And then we chose some control groups too. So we used the Ho, the Quileute, and the Hump Tulips as control because they didn't experience a big change in the philosophy in terms of harvest. They also mimic our systems. I mean, we can always pick holes and
how we chose these control groups, but essentially it was among the groups of streams that are managed in the North Coast, we chose all of them that had quality data, right? That was the criteria. And so what you expect then, if you're seeing a significant impact, is that if run size didn't change these control groups, you'd expect you'd expect the statement to be the same before and after the treatment. But for the impact, if harvest shifts in harvest made a difference, you'd see an increase in a statement. When you don't see it, it's an increase in the control. So we call that as an interaction between the two variables. Alternative version of this would be that the controls go down and the impact stays the same. But technically, the slopes of the differences are what's important here. And so, assessing, one of the things we needed to do is just assess whether, statistically, whether our policy had an influence on how many fish we were catching, right? So that's sort of the first step here. All this to say, essentially, that the top model is our policy status based upon year, and that and the impact versus control site. So this interaction up here, this is the one that we were looking for. This is our top performing model. These two, you can't differentiate between the two. So for the nested term of a year in drainage. And all of this just formalizes essentially that we are seeing these differences here between these two groups, our treatment groups, but no difference between these over here. So we are seeing an effect on catch, right, in terms of the policy. Now we have to ask the question, well, did that translate into measurable benefits in terms of escapement? And so here's the red-based escapement estimates for wild origin and hatchery-based escapement for salmon in Long Bay. And so this graph over here is the wild escapement for Chinook, and this is our hatchery origin escapement for Chinook. And so when you take a look at our Willapa Bay and the Chehalis group, well, we do see a numerical increase, right, at Willapa Bay. It's not at the magnitude that you might expect, given the magnitude of the difference in terms of our harvest rates. Similarly, we have a similar pattern over here with Chehalis, too. And as you would predict, essentially our control groups don't appear to have changed in terms of escapement. sort of a similar pattern over here with our hatchery organisms. We don't have hatchery programs in the Philly and the Ho. Hump tulips sort of saw a small increase. Chehalis, no bump. And then at Willapa, we do see a fairly significant bump in our hatchery rack returns. And so, again here, this is just formalizing our ideas, statistically speaking. So, can we detect a pattern for that interaction? And so, I highlighted it in red here. This is the interaction that we were looking for that would formalize whether we're seeing an actual benefit in terms of red-based escapement. And it's the sixth model. So, the top-performing model, essentially, is just the drainage. The impact versus control status and the total catch. The drainage-only model performed significantly better here than our interaction. So statistically speaking, even though we do get a numerical increase in the red abundance in terms of our estimates, statistically speaking, they're not distinguishable from one another. sort of put all this together, though. All right. And so, looking at the total catch here, you can see that dramatic reductions in terms of harvest. Right, we reduced harvest by 48.9%, given run sizes were the same across the policy years and the non-policy years. What's that?
Were they?
Sorry.
You said given they were the same size, were they?
Provided. So if they were. Okay. We don't have a measurement of an accurate independent measurement of run size. So if they were identical in those 4 years before and 4 years after, then it's a 48.9% increase, right? But while Chinook red-based escapement estimates only increased by 4.97%, it's small, right? Hatchery rack-based escapement plus the hatchery spawning increased by 17.3, totaling a 22.1 bump in escapement, which doesn't come close to our 48.9% that we're missing, right? So where did these fish go? They disappeared on us. Because what we know for sure is that we passed those fish into the system, right?
Are they not allowed?
Well, okay, that's a great question. I think we could address that. But run size is more complicated, and so there are a couple of mechanisms as to why we may not be detecting these fish, given that they were there. So run size is obviously more complicated than our simplistic model, right? We've got a bunch of sort of compensatory mechanisms that might explain differences in escapement, so increased disease as abundance increases, right? That's a possibility. Depredation may increase if you allow more fish to go into the system. You might get changes in dispersal, so compensatory dispersal, fish get crowded and decide I'm not going to go here, or environmental conditions. In other words, fish might be pushed into habitats that aren't comfortable for them because of territoriality. In addition to these sort of compensatory mechanisms, there's also possibly issues with our red-based escapement survey methodology. One of the things that we know for sure is that we don't survey those habitats. We don't select them randomly. Personal communication with folks in the agency suggesting these surveys were created long before any of us were here. Suggests that they were chosen because for the bang for your buck, right? The highest abundances. Well, when you pass more fish through, it's possible you go to those sites that are highest abundance, they fill up, and you get a lot of spillover into submarginal habitat, so areas where fish we wouldn't normally survey, and fish normally wouldn't be present, but in times of high abundance, they may spill out into those areas. So it may explain why we're not finding those fish. They may be making it to the spawning grounds, and we just can't detect it, right? So, essentially, what we found here is that we did reduce fishing pressure. We know that for sure, right? We didn't find significant evidence that reductions in harvest increased wild origin Chinook escapement, but that's but not finding it doesn't mean that the pattern isn't there, right? So absence of evidence is not evidence of absence, right? We have to be sure that we don't come to those conclusions. And there are a bunch of other reasons other than the fish just not showing up at the spawning grounds that might be associated with not counting those fish, including sampling protocols, simplistic assumptions based on our calculations, and then smaller sample sizes, right? So increase your sample size high enough and you can find a pattern, right? Yeah, so with that, I can take any of your all's questions.
Can we have Tim first?
Yeah.
I'm keeping track, and then Bob, you're next, and then I see Francis.
Awesome.
Okay.
You ready?
Yeah, go ahead, Tim.
Go for it.
First, my own curiosity.
Sure.
You do?
Yeah.
You've gone through the little bubble policy, described it all, but there's some facts that I'm not seeing.
Okay.
First off, you were a rookie, and the department was supposed to go to here in Seattle, following this program. And it says, now, we didn't have a significant change here, but someone forgot to tell them they went to Olympia, turned right, and went to Longview for a long lunch, and you came back. You're gauging against the policy as it was written. Where are we showing the impact of this department modifying the policy repeatedly, ignoring it, reinterpreting it, and keeping the harvest high to the point where we can't get out in 16 to 21 years? Okay? The harvest rate of 20%, in my memory, was set by a time figure. What we would agree to would be the time of restoration was 16 to 21. AHA said 20 and 14. We didn't do it once at any time, in any place. So be disappointed with the policy results is something I have a little problem with. I understand where you're coming from. But I'm telling them it is not a reflection of this department's behavior in this policy at all.
Honestly, I don't know how to respond. I mean,
you understand what my problem is.
Sure, I get your issue. I mean, I'm just looking at it from a data perspective. It, in another scenario where management actions were different, maybe the outcome would be different, but really I'm just dealing with the past. So essentially, what was done, right, what were the results of those actions?
There could be a different
outcome, provided there were different actions, but
this is a data analysis of what happened.
Yep.
It is not a reason as to why it happened.
No. Yeah, it's just, yeah, exactly. Yeah, right. Yeah. I make no claims about why.
You could also argue this is how we failed.
That's how you would like to characterize it, that's fine. I don't know if those are in there, right? I don't know if that you'll have to work to get to the fail part. But nonetheless, that's up to you to characterize it in the way that you'd like to.
One last one.
Yep.
We ran AHA. I want to see AHA. I want to see AHA. I want to see AHA. As to where it would have shown us we've gone if we had adopted this policy,
uh-huh. Yep.
Right into the toilet, the ESA.
Okay.
I want to see where it is, when we did the policy, which is what you're doing here,
mm-hmm.
And then I want to see it again if we had actually honored the policy as written. Where that area would go.
It'd be interesting to see. We were discussing
this. Keep in mind, Tim, that this is one section. Some of the things you're talking about are successive parts of it. This one section of the analysis just looks at answering that very simple question. We all accepted a policy based on the assumption that if we reduced fishing pressure, we would see more fish on the spawning grounds.
Yep.
That's what we said. If we stopped killing them, then they would show up to the gravel. And what we're saying in this report is, we did reduce pressure. We reduced pressure by half.
Yep.
Half. In the 4 years prior to implementing the policy to the 4 years after, catch of just total landed Chinook, not Willapa origin, just whatever, just Chinook landed, is half of what it was. And what we saw is a 4.9% increase in wild spawner escape.
So, but remember what I said at the end, right? I did not say that the change in Chinook escapement is 4.98%. I said
correct.
The
that's
change
our
in
our
estimates is 4.98%. It's qualitatively different, right?
It's
so that doesn't mean that we didn't say
I got you wrong, sir.
Yeah, yeah.
You gave us the harvest figure, sir, the impact scale. We combined bracket, right?
Mm-hmm.
Show me where it changed when we started to go back up and you moved to a enhanced catch by a non-selective gillnet. You aren't showing me that. You're blending it together. You're not showing me why
this
happened.
To some extent, yeah. So we could maybe further parameterize the model in a way that captures some of those variations. Maybe you and I could get together and discuss some ideas about how we could do that, because I'm open to it. A lot of the variables that we try to use in these analyses tend to be confounded, right? They're collinear, they're calculations of calculations, so we have to be clear about what we actually have. But if you've got ideas, I would love to see if we can put something together that would make it work.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Yeah, absolutely.
Bob.
Oh, yep. Yes.
All right. Now, I'd like to make a comment on it.
Sure.
Because one of the things I see, this is we did not find significant evidence that reductions in harvest resulted in an increase in wild orange and Chinook escapement. I think a lot of that goes back to what the Willapa system will actually hold and carry as far as spawners.
That's possible.
And we keep trying to sidestep that whatever reason, but let's think of that actually. Appreciate what you come up with, the way you put it together. But I don't think by cutting the harvest down like we did,
that's a distinct possibility. Compensatory depredation
is minimal as far as reducing that harvest rate. And I think we're trying to create something here that never was really here. The Wolfaw system is not a Chinook system. It's never been. It's always, if you look back at Susan Motor report, the whole works, these fish were not here. They're basically chum, almost primarily chum for the whole system, with some cullen, some steelhead. So, I mean, this is what we need to look at. So why are we trying to build something that's not here? And as far as DSA goes, nobody I talked to at NIMS says they have no reason for this wolf function.
Well, all right, so here's two, I would say two things to that. One, are you certain that there weren't Chinook here, right? And if you are, I would love to see the research that I don't know. I just want to see it, right? Because I don't know. And then the other thing I would say is that your conclusion about it being a carrying capacity issue. So in other words, we're putting more fish than the system can hold. It's a valid hypothesis, but we cannot tell that apart from whether it's just site selection, for example, in our survey methodology. Based on the analysis, I just can't say whether it's density dependence or the fish actually returned and we just didn't measure them.
Well, I believe what's happened here in the last few years are spotter surveys and the reliability has actually increased.
Well,
the training of the crews in
that. So, I mean, I don't know how you can tell that. I mean,
because of the way they're looking at it and the way they're approaching it. I mean, that's the whole thing. But every year, conditions are a little different, too.
Right.
So, and we got low flow conditions. We have a lot of fish dying in the river, period.
No, so that's a possibility, too, yeah.
And that's not a possibility. You ask anybody here that's seen it, to do that. You know, so, I mean, that's something we need to look at realistically. And on last year, I think that's what you're trying to do here. But I mean, and then the other part is a real factor is the disease part.
Possibly. Yeah, all of these could account for our lack of counts, right?
Oh, yeah, exactly.
All of them could. But also, like I said, the way we select our study sites, for example, could also do that, right? If the fish might actually be out there. So one of the things conceptually that's a little puzzling is that if you believe we really did reduce our fishery by 50%, then those fish are somewhere, right? Because they made it over the bar. So
how do you know they made it over the bar?
Well, if you believe our reduction,
you got to know it with the commercial fish.
What we're looking at here is essentially these both shifted downwards in terms of overall harvest.
Now, every harvest manager we've ever had relied on the commercial fishery to predict run size. Period. Since they discarded that. They don't know what the hell's coming across the bar. And you tell them where the bar is in the Wolfaw, because it changes every day.
Basically, folks, what he's looking at is the run sizes here. Now, if we looked pre-policy and we were at run sizes of 10,000
we'll call it terminal run size.
Terminal run size. Thank you, Francis, for that clarification.
Terminal run size
in these 4 years versus these 4 years are all in the same category. They're about 3,000 to 4,000 fish. So, in those years, pre-policy, we harvested 20,000. We've had no appreciable difference in run size between these years and these years. Now we're harvesting 10,000. So these fish, under similar run sizes, were harvested before, and now they're not. And we don't see them in any of the other bins to this level.
You're seeing about
that gives stuff. Us a problem. There is a problem.
Hey, you know, I don't have the floor on it.
I'm just asking for clarification.
We're having a discussion, guys. We're going to let it be this.
But everyone should know.
I'm just clarifying the point so that
everyone's on the same page, Bob.
There we
terminal
go.
Run size is important. I think everyone understands that the comparable run size, 10,000 less fish disappeared, we're only able to account for about a fifth of those fish,
yep.
is what I'm
Boom.
Saying.
Yeah,
I don't think that's not clear to everybody. I'm just making it clear.
The way that we address it that way, you shouldn't have to correct it.
It's in there. I don't think everybody.
That's what we're trying.
That's
why we're trying to.
It's not for me. It's for the benefit of the group. It's how it works.
All right, thank you.
Just so that I can explain this, the way that you can tell, essentially, is this is... So these are our treatment groups. These are the ones that experience differences in policy. These are our control groups. They didn't experience differences in policy. These are not different from one another before and after the policy. These are, right? So the conclusion that you can come to that I don't think is spurious is that the treatment groups, the policy groups, experienced a reduction in harvest. And you can also come to the conclusion that run sizes weren't significantly different, right? Because these essentially would shift relative to run size, right? On average, right? It's a rough approximation. We don't have we don't have an estimate of run size, and we got to be careful because what you said is true about run size. We've always depended on the commercial fleet to tell us about what the run size is. That's problematic because it's determined by effort, right? You know, if you go out there and fish more, you catch more fish. That means that you just add those up, right? There's no index. There's no, like, catch per unit effort or anything. You just add it up. And then that gets added to our escapement, and that's the run size. Those are spurious. Right?
Well, basically, what happens is if we actually raise more hatchery, we should have fish for everybody.
Well, I don't know.
We know our natural spawners are not... They're limited on the area they've got to spawn in, and plus the rearing habitat. So, I mean, that's what comes back to.
That's a possibility. That's not in my analysis, but we can discuss that further, too, if you'd like. It's a question we might be able to track down.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, I got Francis.
Okay, I would just suggest a couple other ways that those 80% disappeared in some black hole that we can't find. Number one, the spawning survey is dead on. We don't know that those are the appropriate indices. You put depredation on there. I think your interpretation on depredation, that we have more density, that maybe the seals catch more fish. My thing is that the fish encounter the gear. Something changes after the fish encounters the gear and it's turned back. That fish is not the same fish. It is much more susceptible to depredation. There's a person that attends these meetings year after year after year, has been on this agency to account for sea lion predation, especially after the fish come in contact with the gear. They are in a weakened state. I mean, to some degree. I don't know what that... You know,
I feel like I've seen a study recently that suggests something.
Yeah,
similar.
Okay.
There's all kinds of studies about how fish encountering the gear experience increased mortality and due stress, whether it's sport gear, whether it's gill net gear. Yep. In Alaska, 40% of the sockeye salmon that encounter gill net gear and escape are worthless to the escapement. They count as a number, but they don't contribute to the spawn, other than they add nutrient biomass. Bob has come out and said in years past, quoting a bad study, actually, by Dr. Roland Maul, who's been discredited on that whole thing. But yes, there is an effect. You catch and release a big hen king salmon, you've stressed it out. If it's in transition water and the scales haven't set, the osmo regulatory capacity of that fish is limited, it's going to stress out from lactic acid, and it may swim away, but those eggs might not be viable anymore, or perhaps only half of them are, or a third of them are, whatever it is. So these fish are encountering us with hook and line, and you with your nets. We let them loose. The seals have a heyday with them, even while we're trying to get them. Even before we turn them loose, we're encountering the fish. They're getting eaten. So just because we don't catch them, or they don't end up in a cold, dark aluminum box or in a plastic tote, they can still disappear because of what we're doing.
Absolutely.
It doesn't have to be because of what we're doing either. Just the increased density passing those across the bar, I mean, you can get a functional response from a predator, right? So increased abundances might cause certain predators to switch to salmon, right? The optimal foraging theory suggests that you catch the easiest thing to catch with the most calories. There could be organisms that are like, I'm going to specialize on salmon right now because I can find them all day
There's
long.
There's organisms that specialize in salmon that are struggling on fishing. Okay? I can tell you that right now. You go to the Willamette River, Spring Chinook, and 70% of the encounters end up in the sea lion's belly before they ever make it to a net. Okay? So, you know, you didn't catch them, but they still die. So there's always been, I've been a big subscriber of Hal, can't think of his name. He's in with the Mulgrave group, but he has a famous line that gets repeated on the internet bulletin boards. If you don't kill them, they will spawn. Okay? Emphasis on will. Well, sometimes even if we don't kill them outright, they're going to die regardless because of their incompetence. That's right.
Thank you. Thank you, Francis. Ross?
Thank you. I would say that and I talked to other people, I have a different opinion on the study, and that is that it was incomplete. It neglects a lot of externalities. It doesn't look at some of these. It doesn't look at the prior four-year harvest, as if that might have been over harvest and then limited when it came back this year. It doesn't look at compliance with the policy. It doesn't look for the policy required for payback. We don't do payback. It doesn't look at habitat removal, which commenced in 2014.
We presume habitat is the same before and after the policy.
In 2014, we started typically removing eelgrass, so 14, 15, 16. But 17 and 18...
They're consistent across... To critique that, though, they're consistent across both treatment groups. And those are not groups that I chose, right? Those are the two that just had... So you'd have to explain why it was also true in the Chehalis, if that were your mechanism, right?
Well, I'm not going to try what's true in the Chehalis.
Well, but that's part of the study, Ross. That's the design. So, you know, it's embedded. The design embeds the policy actions across two trains. That's what makes it... That's what gives it...
Basically, Ross, what he's saying is... If what you're saying is true, and it's a fact, we can't say that what you're saying is not true. There could be an effect. We don't know. But what we would see in that instance, if you were 100% correct, is the Chehalis would be here.
Yep, that's exactly what I'm saying.
Because there is no eelgrass spraying in the Chehalis. If all this is explained just by eelgrass spraying, then you would only see that effect in Welsh Bay. You wouldn't see it.
About Chinook, right?
Yes.
Okay.
But you don't see that.
A non-existent fishery for Chinook and the Chehalis. Okay? It's not apples to apples.
Okay.
So habitat removal has a differential effect, and we're harvesting them here, and we're removing habitat, and the Chehalis you're not harvesting them, you're not removing habitat. So I think you should look for differences. Okay. We have no herring spawning mats in this bay anymore. In the case of why some of them don't show up, for example. In the NEMA last year, I think we had a modern record of wild fish that was put up above. They all had, they couldn't find any of them spawn. So they didn't count. Well, they died.
Well, yeah, that's part of the
because of man-made right? conditions that we don't normally have in that record, and we have. Okay. This is a 1H analysis in a 4H system. We have a 4H policy. If you remove the policy and if you remove HSRG, then this is really operating in a vacuum.
No, that's not true.
You're also
Russ,
you
don't give me time to respond. That's not true. Okay. This again, that's the power of the vacuum design, is that most of those get washed out. Unless there's big differences, essentially that are simultaneously achieved at only the treatment sites but not at the controls, right? That's why we do this, is
what's
so that we can
pull
the treatment sites were the policy sites. So I should call them policy sites.
Okay.
So the policy sites reduced harvest, and so all we're looking for is just an increase in escapement. So if that were true, Ross, you would expect that those locate, we would, the results would be way noisier, right? We wouldn't see this from ruins. Essentially, where you've got no change in harvest over here, right, in these control groups. And remember, I told you I did not select these because of the way that these look. I only considered three treatment groups, right? Three control groups. And these are the only three that I consider. I never looked at whether they went up or went down. So I only considered the ones that
opposed to this Chehalis versus Little Quebec. Okay. How do you think the eelgrass habitat in the Chehalis system and in the Grays Harbor, how do you think it compares to the eelgrass habitat in Little Quebec?
I don't know.
There's a huge amount more in Little Quebec than there is.
I get you, but hold on a second. Ross, stop for just 1 second, please. This is the question we are trying to answer with this analysis. That's it. That's it. That's it. If we reduce fishing pressure, do we see more fish on the spawning grounds? That's it. That's all there is. We will have other parts of the comprehensive review. This is just a section where we ask this question. This is an assumption that we made by implementing this policy. We said that if we reduced fishing pressure, we would get more fish on the spawning grounds. Now we have collected some data, and we're analyzing that assumption. That's it.
We never said that.
Ross, that's an assumption of the analysis. Why did we? So then, why in your mind would we institute a harvest control group? Why did we go down to 20%?
We don't want to continue with the point that I'm making, please.
Go for it.
Okay. These externalities that you're ignoring make the study invalid.
I'm not ignoring them.
Get out of the way, please, so I can read it. Okay. Does fishing pressure reduce? Does reducing fishing pressure on Chinook Sound result in a measurable conservation benefit? Okay. By itself, the answer is you can't tell.
But Ross, I think what's going on here is that maybe we need to discuss discuss the backy, the before after control impact design, because I think that's where you're getting caught up, right? You're right that I don't explicitly address habitat. That's true. I didn't measure eelgrass. I did none of that. But the backy design is set up such that we can control for that.
Well, you need to.
I did.
I'm telling you, by using the backy, that's what this does.
But Ross, I'd love, honestly, we could nerd out together about this afterwards. I'm certain that we'll both enjoy it.
We're not going to hash it out afterwards, okay?
Well, I mean, I don't understand. I mean, you want me to explain how a backy works in front of everyone?
No.
Okay. Well, then I don't know where else to go. Okay. All right.
It also admits two major successes that we had during this time that relate to returns. Okay. Number one, it's the first time in history when we mark fish so we can tell who it's who. It's the first time in history that we achieve the escapement goal in the Willapa River. Right? Yeah, it is. Okay. Silence on that.
Well, that's not
that's the primary
that's
river.
Part of this analysis.
Ross, it's
Ross,
right
once
there.
Again,
listen, let me
once again, this is just this specific question. You're taking us into places that have nothing to do with this analysis.
Just the
this
question.
Analysis just looked at that question.
If you hand this to the commission, you're taking them into places where they don't know what the hell they're doing.
Ross, this isn't the document. This is just one piece.
But you said it to them, right?
Yes, I absolutely did.
I rest my
with the same email that you received. We can pull that up and go through it. But what you're characterizing here is inaccurate.
I've got two more things to say.
Okay.
And I'd appreciate not being interrupted. Okay. It's the first time in history we reached escapement in the Willapa River. Okay. It's the first time in history that 2 years ago that we achieved PHAS in the Nazelle. Now, that's just the primary and secondary river of this whole system. And it doesn't come up in any of your analysis. Why? Because you're just looking at 1H.
That's just not...
And those are externalities that are very...
Okay, we're moving on.
No, you're interrupting me. Those are externalities that are very important to decision makers.
We're done. We need to move on. Everybody else gets to talk to us. Mark, you're next.
So I think you've done the right analysis to answer the question that you have set up to answer there. I'm really struck by looking at this, there's 10,000 Chinook salmon that aren't being accounted for somehow.
Yep.
That's what struck me. And what I am wondering, my question is, Your descriptions of possibilities there, some of them would require the surveyors to see a pretty high level of pre-spawning mortality where you're getting carcasses that are not spawned. And I'm wondering if that was something that you did see, because some of those the disease, the environmental, the there's not enough spawning habitat, so the fish don't have anywhere else to go.
You
see a lot of carcasses where the fish weren't.
We do. So we do characterize pre-spawning mortality when we can find it. We obviously are only looking at females for that. There's no mechanism for us to tell whether a male has spawned once or not at all. But we do look at that for females. The problem that we have is we don't have a robust enough survey strategy to be able to expand those out. So we're making what we produce in terms of pre-spawn mortality are just minimum counts. That's a minimum level that we saw while we were on the spawning grounds. We're not able to expand those out. Another part that you bring up is carcasses, and that's a big part of this. We don't recover a whole lot of carcasses. We've talked about this before. I've shared it with the commission. I've talked about the proportions of carcasses that we get in relation to what we're expanding out to the total run size. For Chinook, we're down somewhere between 1 to 2, 3, some years maybe as high as 5% that we get that we get that information for. For coho, it's less than 0.2%. So those carcasses are how we determine origin composition. If our survey strategy is not randomized, is based on most bang for your buck when these guys set it up, right? There's two reasons they picked an area. Logistics, right? There's a lot of our area that's behind locked logging gates. There's not really accessible roads. There could be barriers to that. It could be too long of a hike from the nearest road spot to get to the river to survey there. So those sections weren't considered. The other thing that they looked at when they set these survey sites up is they didn't have a whole lot of funding. It was just a bio and maybe one tech staff at that point in time. So they needed to go out. They couldn't afford to go out and see a bunch of zeros. They needed to see fish. So they picked areas where they knew they were going to see fish and the largest abundances of fish. That survey methodology has never been gone through in a robust scientific evaluation of what we're doing is right. What is the precision of our estimate? And then within that, what is the precision of us being able to say so many of those are natural origin and so many are hatcher origin, given the limited number of carcasses that we get? That all those things... all those things go into these red boxes that we don't have. We don't have.
Well, I mean, one of the problems, too, is the persistence time of a carcass. That's one of the things that I've been battling with. I don't know. Well, I just don't know. Essentially, my guess is that it's probably the shorter than the frequency with which we survey. So simply adding them up, you know, in terms of... that we estimate. But seeing a big shift in mortality, we might be able to detect that. I totally agree. It's surprising. So if I had to put money on it, my guess is that it's the survey methodology that explains it. I've seen research that suggests that distributions change under different abundances, right? So high abundances, fish word out into those submarginal habitats. This was for the Snake River fishing study. So my guess, honestly, is that we're probably the fish are, I don't know, right, but chances are the fish are on the spawning grounds and we're just not measuring them. So that would be one of my first steps once we finish the policy is to try to revisit our survey methodology to see if we're not missing out on fish that are present just based on our methods. Yeah.
There's another aspect.
That's a ton of fish.
There's another aspect of this that we've talked about quite a bit. Alan and Jack have keyed in on it many times over the last few years. How come the encounters that we see in the marine area do not match what we see in the spawning grounds? We see a lot more natural origin fish just in the data that we send out every week with the impact by area summary that you guys get every week. You look at those. Look back on those. Look at those individual stat weeks where you see an unmarked to mark ratio of 0.8, 0.5, 0.6, right? So for every 100 fish, 50 of them are unmarked and 50 of them are, or 80, you know. And then when we go and we look at our spawning escapement data at the end, it's right about 10% every time. How come we're seeing all these here and we're not seeing them here?
Francis told you they get eaten.
No, we know that, Ross. What we're trying to do is being able to quantify what these are. It doesn't help to say, yeah, we know they're eaten. How many are eaten? What proportion?
We don't know.
We can't answer that. And these are important considerations in thinking about this and where we should be. What's the carrying capacity of the bay? What's the right harvest level to set? So there are still some things that we don't know. That we don't know.
I have a suggestion on how to do that.
Yeah, okay.
Love
to talk about that.
Okay.
So not right this second, but we will we can talk about that at a later date. So yeah, I mean, you know, we've seen evidence of this in other places. This is just backing that up. We've got some fish here that are going unaccounted for, and we've got to figure out how to account for them. That's for us. That's for us, right? That's for us to decide on how to do and what's best to move forward, what sort of funding requests we need to put in to be able to answer these questions. But what we want to do here is make sure we're telling you guys what we know and what we don't know. What this data is good for and what it isn't good for. Where we can talk about what that means for management and where we're... It is what it is. This is what we know. So, anyway. So, moving on, let's see, I had Tim next.
I should have told you when I started.
Okay.
We're going to have ourselves a double advocacy over here.
Good. I love it.
Love your science. I love your commitment to it and all that. I have a high school diploma. I tell us a lot. Okay. You go out and talk to people in the street. There's no enough spawners in the ground. Okay. 99.9% of them say, quit killing this guy. Both of them, science has figured out we can quit killing half of the fish in the field and make a difference. Fish coming
that's
home.
No, that's not the conclusion. That's not the conclusion. Don't say that. That's not the conclusion.
I'm reading the conclusion. We do not find significant...
No, that...
The toxic harvest resulted in increased wild birds and escape.
That exactly. We did not find significant evidence for it. That does not mean that we did not... We did that we did that the statement didn't increase. That just means that we didn't.
We didn't detect it.
You understand
qualitatively different.
I've gone through some of the data scientific things. 35 years of patrolling the industry, we've never seen.
Okay.
That when science totally conflicts with what you see with your own two eyes, you get worried.
Okay.
You get worried. Okay. I'm not casting aspirations on you. I'm going to tell you that I disagree with this. You guys chose it, you guys did it, and I'm requesting a disclaimer in front. You put in there, it shows right out of here, you got to watch. Who chose this approach?
What's that?
Look at weekend table, people who disagree. In other words, I disagree. I disagree with you on this, okay? So you put it out there, we've got a disclaimer on it, it implies somehow. I'm agreeing, and I don't like that.
Wait, I'm sorry, I missed that.
When you send this on to the way to the commission, now we have to go to the commission and tell them we disagree. I don't want you to filter.
We're not asking whether you agree or not with the work that we've done. The analysis stands alone.
Just say so. Put it up front so people know that we are agreeing with these reports.
Well, you're free to give your opinion to the commission or whatever. We're not.
We'll summarize
your comments here tonight, and we'll give those to the commission.
I need you to explain to people that I don't agree. And
that's fine, Tim. You can not agree. You can choose not to agree. That's fine.
You're not a co-author, are you?
No. Okay. But if you sit down and say this was produced with the systems of the freshman class at this school, you're implying everybody in that class was involved.
We're doing is sharing this with you to get feedback, and then we will coalesce some of your feedback into my presentation to the commission in October, and I will characterize that. You will also be able to do that. But we're not asking whether you agree with the work or not. No, that's not what I said. I said we will give your comments to the commission. Barb is summarizing them. I will stand right up front, and when I go through what the public comment was on the comp review, I will add that they didn't agree with our analysis. I got no problems doing that. This is not your document. This is our document, an agency.
That's what I'm asking you to tell us. That's what I'm asking you to tell us right up front.
But your name's not at the bottom. There's nothing in there that says that you agree with it. What I'm saying is I'm not going to put a section in the document in this paper that says the advisory group didn't agree with our analysis.
Why not?
Why would that be part of a technical report?
Because I fear that some of them will believe we did.
Or you never invited
us. Jay, I'll be more than you'll be happy to come to the commission, and we've got this on audio. Everyone will be sure about that you don't agree. Yeah.
So with that said, though, Tim, I'm happy to include any thoughts that you have. Really, if you've got substantive comments that change the analysis significantly, or maybe there's philosophical challenges.
Do you know how far the average citizen is going to get? About a page and a half. You know that. Okay? So if you put down your tobacco, Tim said this, Tim said that, you're going to see it.
But it was right at the summary. It's in the summary. It's right in front of you in the summary. It's on the summary in the very first paragraph. So again, we don't have to do that. I would love to take your comments and incorporate them if they're significant.
I will make sure the commission knows that you don't agree with that. Alternatively, if you come back, they were aware of that when you moved option C, and you did that. Here we go again. So Tim, I'm an open book here, right?
Like I am 100% willing. I'm 100% willing to hear you. Okay, well that's fine. But what happens here is all right. This is all. So if you've got problems with the analysis or the data that I use, then you should talk to me, and we'll work together to make it better. I promise you that will happen. Nobody's looked at this before I presented. Nobody said you can't present these data. Everything I put together has come to you unadulterated without anybody's thumb on. I promise, right? So again, if you come to me with comments that you think are substantive, and I think they are too, because maybe there are some philosophical changes, you know, that we need to rethink it, I would be more than happy to do it. Because what I'm after here, Tim, is just to get to the answer. Just to get to the right answer. I don't care about politically what happens, none of that. Okay? So I hope that reaching out is helpful, and I hope you take me off topic. Okay?
Yeah. Okay. North.
I like to put myself out there, like go over there, you know. I drive an old pickup truck, you know, maybe my neck gets a little sunburned and turned a little red here and there, and that's all fine with me. You know, I read this report 3 times. Once was last night because I thought yesterday was the 14th. And I was sitting down there in the parking lot. I had time to go over there.
But
the report did that.
But you know, I sat there and read it for the third time. And I certainly appreciate the work that is put into this report. I understand it's a technical report. My background isn't as letters like Ross's, but my background, I worked in medical technology. When new research would come out, I would have to read the technical analysis. When I worked as an instructor in the Naval Shipyard at Bremerton, I worked in an electroplating shop, and when you start looking at the chemistries and whatnot and the technical data there, I had to educate myself on, one, how to read a technical paper, and two, I had to have a technical dictionary to learn what some of the terms meant so that I could interpret them and pass them on to my students. There's some very smart people with Fish and Wildlife Commission, but there's some little boys and gals in the Fish Commission too. And one of the things I'm seeing here tonight is a lack of comprehension of methodologies and the terminologies that are included. If this is not meant as a criticism,
no,
it's meant as an observation.
It's tough, yep. It's tough
for folks that have to make a decision.
Yep.
Okay, on what they may or may not do, and I'm basing this on that little sheet you're putting out for the future through North Valley in 2020. That's a fast track. That's a pretty fast track to try to take a paltry 4 years of data, and I use the word paltry purposely, because originally we were looking at 20 plus years of being able to see any results from what we're doing, or what being attempted here. And so it took me three readings to understand probably 85% of what's written. But here's what I think I understand. One, harvest was reduced. And it's demonstrable.
Yep.
Based
yep.
on that one chart that you put out there.
Yep. So this.
Two, I did not see really a significant discussion in terms of the variances that occur in each 4 year period. In other words, run size versus estimated run size versus actual run size. There were some significant differences during both those 4 year time steps. And I don't see them parsed out for policymakers to understand that there are some variables here that may not be or may not be captured fully in this analysis. One of the other items I zeroed in on that was the reduction in harvest. Versus what we decided as an advisory group versus really what was, and again this goes back to probably a different section that we put forward, but in terms of giving them an analysis of did it make a difference, there are some variables here that occurred that would not be seen in the next 16 years. Specifically, those 3 years that we sat at 20% before we reached 14%. One of the things I did not see stated is that if we had reduced harvest to 14%, would we see a more significant increase of fish on reds?
Yeah, I don't know. No, that's a good. We don't know.
Yeah, we don't know.
That's just it. We don't know.
Absolutely.
But it is not.
It's not in
parsed out there, so that the folks that are going to make the policy decisions understand that given the data, that first statement that's made, reducing harvest increases productivity of wild Chinook in Oklahoma Bay. We did not take the initial recommendations of where it should be. The initial recommendation was 14%. And we sat here and argued about that. And I was on the fence about it because...
No, that's a valid point. Whether we would have detected... If we would have been at 14, what might have the response been at
exactly.
that point?
Yeah. We don't know.
Right. Let me think about that.
We cannot answer that question unless we continue, I would say, for at least another 4 years to see...
But more than likely.
To take that data and in the conclusion... I understood what the conclusion said. The conclusion is very simple.
Yeah.
We don't know. That's what you said.
Yeah.
We don't know whether it worked or it didn't work.
Yep.
What I would like to see included is that the next four-year time step isn't going to have the number of variables as the first four-year time step.
Okay.
And for me, in an analysis, whenever you can put a constant across the time period, your data becomes that much more reliable.
Absolutely.
So
those are my comments on this report. I would like to see an addendum put out, including, I mean, Tim kind of was talking about it. I understand that this is your report. I see the authors on the report, and I understand that that's a report that has already went to the commission.
But it's a draft to, all over it, too.
It's a draft, I understand. Yeah. And since it is a draft, I would ask that an addendum be included summarizing some of the comments that you've heard here tonight that may or may not be valid.
Yep.
But that the commission may need to be aware of, because if I go to the commission, I'm given 3 minutes. I've already spoke for over 5. There's no way that I can articulate in 3 minutes the concerns that I have, and I do not believe that they were overlooked purposely. I believe that they were probably were looked at, but there was no way to truly capture that data so that it could be put on a linear line. This is more of a hyperbole because of the differences in harvest.
14
to 20%. I'm done. Thank you.
Thank you.
Let's see,
Marlisa. Thank you, Norm. That was well done. And thank you, Damon, for the effort on putting this presentation together. It's nice to hear a new voice there. Thank you for that. I have a lot to say, and I have to tell you that my first impression when I read this was, oh, no. If I were anybody reading that didn't know all the side pieces that go on, all the variables that are happening within our watershed, I would have looked at it and said, well, why do they bother them? I mean, that would be my immediate statement, even though you made these little lines in there that say that...
I hope they're not little. I hope they're ginormous.
I think for the normal person, they're looking at the way it's presented that the benefit was minimal. And
That's not what I said, and it's not what it says.
Well,
I hope
just,
those caveats are thinking.
I understand and I respect your paperwork.
That's not how we're characterizing it, and that's not how I will characterize it in my presentation to the commission. The study is what the study is.
And I see you too. I have to say this. Please allow me to keep my train of thought going.
Yep, go ahead.
And you might not like what I have to say, but please respect my time to speak.
Yeah, go ahead.
Please. So that was my impression, and I'm like, oh my gosh, well, did they take in all these mitigating factors? And so learning that you have not, it makes me feel a lot better about this, but I have to say that the people on the commission are comprised of individuals that advocate for various results with the policy, both pro and against the policy, and that's the way it reads. I think that's the way some people are going to interpret it, is that the results were minimal for the tremendous amount of effort. But I'm moving on from that point. So I would hope, two things, that this is a valid question that you base this analysis on, that there are going to be other valid questions asked, and if so, what are they going to be? What other valid questions in analyzing the policy are you going to be studying? I have some suggestions. And if you have some bullet points, like 1 through 5, and they're only going to be 1, I mean, this is your draft, what's coming?
What's coming, so the next parts that Damon will be, that we'll be working on are the policy effects on commercial and recreational fisheries. So we'll be looking at things like the stock composition of the fishery, how it transpired pre versus post, what did we expect. We've got some of the aha runs that Tim brought up earlier that expected us to be at certain levels across certain years. We'll be able to compare that to what aha predicted and where we are now. So we'll work through some of that. There's also a stock assessment aspect that we'll talk about, the policy effect on stock assessment, where we'll get much more robust about the methods and accounting and all that sort of stuff. We'll provide some recommendations once we're done with our analyses. We also have a section on hatcheries
that'll be pretty minimal from our point, but we will be including the hatchery evaluation and assessment team that's finalizing a CWT analysis of Willapa, Forks, Nacelle, and Nema. They've got some really great data that they've been working
those
on.
Those are broad and important, but specifically, the policy was designed to, one, increase the escapement of Welshnut. And another major component of the policy was to increase a meaningful recreational fishery
Absolutely.
In both the bay
yeah.
and fresh water.
Yeah.
You have to ask yourself, did the policy do that?
Absolutely.
If it did not, and here's the challenge of comparing the past 4 years, previous 4 years, with these 4 years, of, you know, what was the actual run size returns? What are we fishing on?
Yeah.
So when we're looking at this particular time frame, 2015, 2016, 2017, and 2018, well, 2015, you know, we knocked it out of the park, and everyone is shaking in their, you know, panties about the actual consumption of recreational fish that were caught out there. I mean, it was amazing.
Yeah.
But then in 2016, 17, and 18, the run sizes just didn't materialize. I mean, it was very difficult, as you know, with 2018 having one fish caught for every 7 trips out of the bay. I think that kind of information somewhere needs to be tucked into your report. It's
absolutely.
It's not just the commercial fishermen that have
no,
suffered
absolutely.
During these last 3 years.
Yes.
I mean, it's not like we took all their fish and they didn't get any. We didn't get any either out there. I mean, the only people who were getting fish were some of the freshwater people on the Nema.
Yeah.
Honestly, I mean, it was pretty grim elsewhere. Even though we had much less than we have had in the past, we still did have some fish to catch because of the policy. Without the policy, we would have had nothing.
Yeah, what you're characterizing is absolutely going to be in our next section. That'll be the next section that we release, will be commercial and recreational fisheries. Damon and I are working on it. Not as we speak, but we have been working on it. We'll continue to work on it, and hopefully we'll have something out in a couple of weeks for you guys to look at in regards to that. So, thank
but
you
yeah,
for
that.
That's the next rung
on the ladder, though.
Yeah, we're right there.
Addressing the commercial and recreational impact on
the policy impact. With my closing comment, all I can say is, although it may not have been your intent, the feeling was, from what I read, was the overall underlying message was that there wasn't a significant improvement in the statement.
So there's another word in there, significant measurable improvement. Right, that's the measurable part is really important, okay? So
perhaps another way to say the same thing was there was nearly a 5% improvement in wildfish escapement in spite of tremendous hardships the estuary and the rivers encountered during these years. I mean, there's another way to say the same thing.
Sure. Well, and again, I didn't say it's only a 5% increase. I didn't say that. I said that's what we measured was a 5% increase, not what actually showed up to the spawning grounds. Again, those are qualitatively different. You just have to remember that right in there there's a whole paragraph about our methodology and how we measure escapement, right? Escapement is supposed to be defined as run size minus harvest, right? Well, that's not exactly what we measure. We measure the number of reds. So those are really different, right? The number of animals that make it back to the spawning grounds to create a red is very different than just the run size minus harvest, right? There's a whole bunch of other places that fish could go. And we also, our measurements it's possible they're biased or they're structured in some way that could produce a pattern that we're seeing here too. And I hope I'm really clear about that in the paper, because if what we're hearing here today, again, if what you heard today was that there's no difference, that is not what I said, and I will go back to that paper and change it so that I'll put them in italics and bold. You know, I don't know what else to do, but I want to make sure that nobody comes away from here saying that we only saw a 5% increase in escapement. I mean, to some, like, that's what we measured, but we don't know if that's actually the difference in it. So that's the caveat. I want to just keep saying that out loud so everybody here hears what I'm saying, okay?
Yep.
Right. Yep.
Okay, one more thing. I really believe that 4 years of data is not enough.
That's possible, too. I did a power analysis that suggested...
Without flinching, the 14% needs to be implemented in the next 4 years, and we need to reserve judgment moving forward. These things do not change overnight. And again, we have faced challenging years of escape of run sizes on these Chinook in the last 3 years, and so hopefully it will be better in the next 4 years. If not, you know, maybe 14% isn't enough either. I hope that somewhere in your analysis you're going to express that 4 years wasn't enough data.
I did.
Oh, yeah, we definitely talk about
there's
sample
a paragraph
size.
About power, which
but
power is about
the
sample size.
That we are actively seeking additional time
yeah.
with the policy as it's written,
yeah.
not with it
well,
being
yeah, I don't know.
Changed to suit.
When I look at some of this stuff, I mean, what we essentially have now is a really good baseline. We have a really good baseline, starting from 2015 moving forward. We've got a very robust recreational monitoring program where we're estimating, we're getting non-local and local stock composition. We're collecting a lot of CWTs. We're getting information around the encounter ratio of unmarked marked fish. We're extrapolating that into weekly estimates of catch and impacts. We've got a very robust commercial monitoring program as well, where we're doing basically the same things. We've increased some of the work that we're doing on the spawning grounds. Now, just throwing more boots on the ground, does that give us any more precision in the data? We don't know. As we've talked about, there's a lot of things here in the spawning ground basket that we're unsure of. We need to do a real comprehensive analysis of that. That's going to take time, it's going to take some money, and it's going to take some effort. And you know, that's probably going to fall once we finish some of this stuff. We can only take on so much stuff at the time. But, yeah, so really good points. Okay, Andy.
One of your first handouts under that exploitation rate, you had the hatchery practices. You want to elaborate on that?
You're talking about, like, just how
he's talking about the very first
fish
slide.
Have been negatively influenced. I'm just
yeah,
talking
yeah.
about how fish have been negatively influenced
right.
over time.
Bad hatchery practices. All we're saying is that's a function
you want
of
me to
why we're at the run sizes that we're at. There could be some over-harvest, and past hatchery practices might have played a role in that,
so,
too.
Right, so in the hatchery, but what part of the hatchery practice?
Well, moving fish around is
moving
one.
Moving fish around.
Right?
Releasing too many.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
really
not putting too many on
sure.
the spawning grounds, releasing not enough. I mean, it really depends.
There's all sorts of hatchery practices that have led to at least that's what much of the data suggests, is that there are a lot of hatchery practices that we've conducted in the past that have led to problems that we're currently experiencing with our fisheries.
With the natural returning
fish? Not with them. Well, I mean, no, I don't know. We don't know. It could be direct competition between hatchery and wild fish. I don't know if that's true. I haven't seen evidence to suggest that, but it's a possibility.
Okay, so next one would be, so you reduce the fishery by half. I don't think I'll get an argument, maybe, but that was the commercial fishery. You knocked out the commercial fishery.
Most of it came from
okay.
the
I'd say 99%.
Yeah. And I think Damon references that in the document. There's a
sentence a little bit.
Most of that
came out of
yeah.
commercial.
And we'll key in on that more when we start looking at recreational and commercial fishing.
Want that doing them. So when you knock them out, you didn't see the gain you thought you would get.
No.
What do you want to look at is 5%? Yes, you gained 5%, okay? Whether that's a big number, small number, everybody's got an interpretation on it. Okay, but at the same point, we've lost half our run.
Well, no. I mean, what we measured was 5%. That's not
right.
That's not what returned. So this is just what we measured.
And we were able to detect.
what we were
right.
able to
detect.
Yeah. Yeah, it was
so
a
can you say that with 100% confidence that if we were fishing, that you wouldn't have got that?
No.
No. Right.
I can't say that. No.
No. Okay, another thing on your graph, you have the hump tulips as a control?
As a control, yep.
The hump tulips are part of the policy.
You're yes. absolutely right. It's outlined in the paper. The reason we include the hump tulips as a control is because it never experienced the control rules. So, functionally, it was a control.
We have never gone to the 5% for hump tulips since the policy has been enacted. We have always been 3 out of 5. So, essentially, here, we implemented a harvest control rule on the Chehalis side. We have never implemented a harvest control rule on the Humptulus side in these years. All the fishery has just been planned around its normal constraints in terms of management objectives. There was not a policy action that reduced fishing pressure in the Humptulus.
Yes, sir. What? You reduced the commercial fishery.
We did not have a harvest control rule.
No, I get what I'm saying. Just a reallocation. We'll call it. Okay, so
the commercial fishery is all after the fish run instead of
that's taken care of in the before after. That's not a control of this sort of in this sort of analysis. What we're looking at
so we're looking for
policy
big
action
changes in harvest.
Okay.
We're looking for big changes in harvest, right?
Harvest
so
care.
What we and essentially the philosophy of harvest, right? So while it's true that the hump tulips was under the policy, the same policy that the Chehalis was, it just never reached the rules, the control rules that would have shifted the harvest philosophy, right?
Yeah.
We were fishing on the
same
paradigm
here.
And yeah, exactly. You can see. I'm sorry, I did that.
Right here.
And you can see it, right?
And we actually harvested more fish after the implementation of the policy than we did before.
Reflection of run size.
No, and that's a reflection of the normal run variations in run size.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I mean, it would make the analysis
right,
cleaner.
Move
if I can
move on.
It would make it cleaner if we. If
I got Francis, Marlisa, Tim.
What about me?
Oh, my fault. Sorry, I got you here too. Okay, and then we're going to move on.
Clarification. So this, the technical paper, has gone out.
Well,
as a draft.
As a draft to the commission. I think it's a technical paper. It should be written in technical style. I don't know if this committee endorses it or doesn't endorse it. I think that's actually appropriate. But on this, the actual slide presentation, they have not seen that yet.
No.
Okay, so I would suggest that on the last slide, since we spent time to change it, that this not finding a pattern does not mean that there is no pattern.
Okay.
There may have been a pattern and we failed to detect it. It should be in big and bold and italic and blue and whatever else it takes to make it stand out, because Thornburg is not going to see it, okay? Sorry, just hold it straight.
Okay. Yeah. No, thank you.
So,
thank you.
You know, you gotta put it.
Yeah.
Fourth grade level reading sound bites that stick out. Otherwise, it.
Perfect. Yeah. No. And exactly. We want to make sure we're very clear. We did not detect a pattern.
Okay, that's good.
Doesn't mean the pattern didn't exist.
Yep.
It means that we did not detect it.
That's
what
we're
saying.
That's fine.
Yeah.
We're not saying anything other than that.
So does that work?
And Francis, Tim, Ross, and Bob?
Bob, something like that.
Just go down the line here. Just go ahead.
A couple points. One of them is we had a first meeting, and we actually discussed the policy and the process. I stated at that time that I believe we need to have the provisions for whatever.
What's
that might work?
Oh.
That you would allow for us to have opportunities to comment in our own language, not speak to the commission through your filter, and you turn me down not once but twice. I want that on record. Secondly, I know we're missing the chart. Could be.
Tell me, you want to know?
Well, I'll tell you, I put 18 dams in a row without a fish ladder. Makes it easy for them. Okay. Underestimating selective fishing mortality. Okay, if you want to see some studies, I'll shove them at you as fast as you want to see them. We're exceeding MSY. The other thing is that when you have a situation where this doesn't explain how you reference and you know that the smaller size should not, or resulting in less 8K, we got to have more account numbers. So I want to suggest you better show what declines productivity that you experienced the hatchery shows. Because yeah. You're not getting eggs in, okay? And those bantless spawners are now out there 4 years later, they aren't coming back, and you're talking to your dad, and that can be a second part.
Yeah, and Tim, just to touch on that part of the heat evaluation, CWT evaluation that we've looked at and known so far, it's pretty conclusive. Willow Bay Chinook are getting younger, smaller, less fecund.
Yep.
It's a fact.
There.
So your points there are valid, and that will absolutely be included. So, Rob?
A couple points. One, I'm getting confused. I think Damon did a good job within the parameters that he was given and he presented.
Yeah.
I tend to look at this like Norm does, as if I were a decision maker, you know. And that's what I meant when I said it neglects, you know, too many eggs to nowadays, and it's not ready for prime time. Here's the other thing I would say, the brotherly love there, okay? When, Chad, when you interrupt 4 out of 5 points I tried to make, it never let me finish it. I'm not feeling the love, buddy.
No, I hear you, Ross, but at the same time, I've got to get things done at these meetings. I've got specific agenda items, and I want to make sure that we have a conversation about the pertinent material, and we're not spinning our wheels on the weeds talking about something that isn't part of what we're talking about at the moment. Right now, and I get, I'm not saying that some of your points aren't valid. They absolutely are. They're not part of this. And this is what we're talking about tonight. We'll meet in September and October with these other sections of the policy where some of your concerns will be addressed. And at that point in time, once we've completed those analyses and written them up, then we can have a conversation about that. At this point in time, we're not done. We don't know what that's going to say yet because we haven't finished the work. So we're still actively putting this together. I hear the point that this is very technical. And I put in an email to all you folks as well. The very same email went to the commission. I understand that this is very technical and this is difficult for folks to understand. I'm sorry about that. But at the same time, this is the most technical part of the work that we're going to do. This was the hardest part, and the most technical in nature, given the question that we were trying to answer. These other sections will not be quite as robust as this. So it will be a little easier to follow. But at the same time, we have to live up to some levels of scientific rigor and use appropriate methodologies. I don't expect you guys to understand that. There's no educational requirement or statistics class that you have to take before you can come sit on this panel. Okay? But, it is what it is.
We could teach.
I'm not feeling the love again.
And I'm not meaning that as a shot, Ross. I'm just saying some of this, you know, some of this stuff, this is going to be the most technical in nature. And
we're ready
to
my
people to understand. There we go. Alright.
So but Ross, no, and then also I'm reason. Happy. I'm but okay. Again, I'll give you the same
I got two more people who would have.
Okay.
Marlisa, and then Bob, and then we'll do public comment.
Again, I think words are important, and if you're presenting this to the commission on your conclusion list here, I think, although it doesn't start with an S, because I don't saw yours start with an S on here, you need to have on here pre-spawning mortality due to disease. You know, this is something that Mother Nature threw at this thing, not, you know, this most of these are, you know, biology sampling protocol, things that you are doing that might be wrong, but you would fail to talk about the physical things that are happening to our fish out.
You're talking about in the presentation.
Okay.
In the conclusions on the bottom of what could have caused this.
Yeah, and we'll definitely be getting into that when we talk about stuff.
I'd like to see that.
Yeah.
In here, you want me to throw in
responding
one more?
Responding mortality due to disease.
Yeah, that's fine.
Okay, Bob, and then we're going to go to the public comment section, please.
I'll keep you short and sweet, but there is something that
I'll just put responding mortality. Is that okay?
What was
it? I think due to disease, you know, is we've had some really weather-related issues that we haven't had those kind of challenges to that degree in the past, but I think it was less than 2 years that have really caused the problems.
Yeah, that's fine.
And I think that we should just understand that.
Okay.
I mean, it's so much information for all of us here, most of which have seen this year after year after year, and I can't imagine that someone else that, I mean, they're on that lesson for volunteering their time on that commission, because they see lots of things other than just fisheries, and it's hard to them. Please spell it out.
Great, thank you. Go ahead, Bob.
One of the things that got missed in this report, I think, big time, what happened to the commercial fishery and the amount of money that was lost?
That's coming.
As we said, that's the next section. That's not part of this question.
Well,
that'll be in the next section.
You know, I want this out there for
you.
Coming next
okay.
time. But not only that, but what happened to Pacific County and the loss of revenue.
Yep.
One quick point, if we had the commercial fishery going, take some of these fish out of the freshwater, we wouldn't have the death toll in the river that everybody's hollering about. Marlisa, screaming 2,000 fish died here last year. We know damn good well she couldn't count that far.
Okay, but let's
the
not
thing
let's
is,
I have the personal attacks, please.
For our economics for Pacific County, period.
Yeah.
And it's devastating the county and the commercial fish.
Okay.
Sure. We will be addressing
all of the issues. Okay. Now, members of the public, and I see a few folks that have to raise hands. When we have advisory group meetings, the conversation is just for the advisory. We set aside some time at the end for public, and now is that time. So, just wanted to make sure for those folks who were new to coming to our meetings that how that works. So, if by show of hands, who would like to give some comments? Clark, right? Clark?
Yes.
Clark, Jack, Alan, sorry.
Thank you,
Alan. Alan, do you want to?
Yeah.
Okay. Let's just start this way and we'll work our way this way. So start with you, Clark. Come on, we need you to come up front and read it into the microphone. Yeah, you can be on deck.
My name is Clark Cottrell. I'm a resident here in Raymond. There's a lot of technical data that has been discussed and is probably way above my pay grade, but I wanted to just very briefly talk about some of the policy goals. I think that it's just a little bit telling. And I guess at the top of the list it says, to achieve restoration of wild salmon, which I think is an admirable goal, but it suggests to me that might be at the cost of hatchery salmon. And we may not agree on a lot of things, but I do believe that most of us here believe that if you get more fish and a bigger pie, that we'll all get more out of it. And so I'd like to see somewhere on the policy goal as increasing the harvest. You had said that you'd like to see the harvest goal change quite a bit, and I assume and hope that you mean that there'll be more fish to harvest. So again, the policy goal of restoring wild salmon to me suggests that at the expense of putting fish into the system via the hatchery. My last comment would be, I don't know how telling this is, but on the list of policy goals, the very last one is to restore and maintain public trust and support. And I guess if you put that last on your list, well, need I say any more?
Thank you, Clark. Alan, who is next? You can come on deck here. Or on deck circle. I say you are.
My name is Alan Holling.
Hollingsworth, retired commercial gillnet fisherman in Willapaw Bay, and also a avid sports fisherman. One of the problems, I think, where a lot of your fish are disappearing, I will estimate there's probably 10,000 seals and sea lions in the bay for a, if you take, let's say, 5,000 of them, gets one fish a week, there's 50, 60, 70,000 fish disappearing right there that's never accounted for, catching them on their own. Also, I think another reason that the escapement level only went up 5% for the wild Chinook is because the run size was overestimated pre-season. We've had some poor ocean conditions, and I think the run was way smaller than you predicted, maybe only 5% bigger than what it was in some of the other years is the only reason you gained 5%.
So the run sizes were the actual run sizes, not the predictions. There are postseason
right.
reconstruction information is what.
But the overall run was this 4-year average was only about 5% higher than it was the several years before that you're taking your preseason data from. Let's see, I had something else, but I can't remember. I wrote it down.
Thank you, Alan.
Yeah. Who's ever next can move up to the on-deck circles.
Are you ready? Hey, my name is Mark Hermes, and I support get rid of the Will of the Bay policy, and I want to see the hatcheries in the Will of the Bay go to maximum capacity of all hatchery fish, and I'd like to see the gillnetters fish August, September, and not in November, so the fish planted the steelhead on the Lake Kohor for the sportsmen. That's it.
Thank you.
Could I ask one question?
You can't after.
I don't know what your affiliation is.
Sportsman.
You're a sportsman?
Yep.
That's what I need. That's what I need to know.
But I support the commercials.
And that's fine. I just...
Yep.
There's a reason for that. I'll talk to you later.
Okay. Dave?
My name is Brent Sewell. I'm a lifelong fisherman, also a fishing guide now. I'm visiting from the Columbia River down here fishing buoy 10. Mark asked me to come to the meeting tonight. I'm go to these meetings up and down the Columbia, and I see a lot of consistency here between the user groups, even here where there's a lot of bickering and a lot of we want this more share than you guys. We deserve more of the share than you guys do, bigger piece of the pie. I think we'll get a lot more out of this throughout the whole system if we work together even stronger. I think we're going down that road now, but I think it needs to be more work done there. I think there's a lot of work that needs to be done with the predators. There's some people in this room, I'm sure, remember Herschel. Those rivers have not recovered up there. I work on the Columbia River. I see those seals and sea lions constantly chewing on salmon, steelhead, sturgeon year-round. I fish above the dam in the Wind River Drano. Those are terminal fisheries. Damn near every spring Chinook we catch up there has been hit by a seal. There's a bigger problem than a lot of people want to admit. So that's about all I have.
There you go, Brett. There. Let me see your hat.
Go ahead.
My name's Dale Beasley, and I'm president of the Columbia River Crab Fishermen's Association. And a couple of years ago, my board members told me to start looking at salmon as an alternate fishery, because if we get a domoic acid event in crab, then our community really hurts. And I quit salmon fishing in 1979 because I could see the bullshit that I see going on here tonight coming over the horizon. And when I started fishing, I made a darn good living at it. Family didn't want for anything. What can I say? Times have changed. And what I see change is policy, nothing else. All of the big dams we're in, all of the bad environmental impacts happened prior to 1980. We've had a little bit happen after that, but not much. Most of it happened 40 or 50 years ago. And this policy decisions that are being made, I'm probably talking to the wrong group here. I should be to the Fish Commission because they're the one that set your policy. And I intend to do that as well. But I've been to a few meetings here over the last couple of years. And every one of them, I've heard one constant. Everyone wants to see more fish to harvest. I don't care if they're a sport fisherman or a commercial fisherman. And if you look at the NOAA surveys offshore in the last few years, 5% of what they catch in a young smolt fish out there are wild. 95% of them are hatchery. In the last couple of decades, this state has quit putting out 160 million hatchery fish in this state. If you're only catching smolts offshore that are hatchery origin, and you cut 160 million of them going out, when they come back, no one has a fish to catch, period. That's sport or commercial. And that's not what the people of this state want. Fisheries management has two parts, fish and people. People are getting left out of the equation in fisheries management. This year, because we had an orca crisis, the legislature authorized more money to put back into hatchery production for a reason, because they knew the people of this state wanted to see dinner plate results. We don't care how they get to that dinner plate or what their origin is. People want fish on their plate to eat and enjoy. And this policy that we have currently here in the Willapa, where people cannot get any fish to eat for their plates, isn't a reasonable policy for either WDF or the commission to be putting forward. And that has to change. And if it has to change, we'll all have to go to the legislature and ensure that it changes. It can't be changed by doing what we're doing. Doing the same old thing isn't going to help. We've got to put more fish out, because if you look at the offshore surveys, what goes on, hatchery fish aren't making it for a variety of reasons. We've got a lot of things going on in our environment today that we cannot control and will not control. And if we don't produce hatchery fish for our people, we're not any of us going to be eating salmon, period.
Thank you.
Tim Hamilton. I want to address the subject of the commission, this policy, and recognize that when you are a stockbroker and you're writing a paper for stockbrokers, you might talk a certain way, but you sure as heck wouldn't talk that way to a first-time investor. I'm asking you, Damon, recognize who the audience is that you're trying to talk to. I know you don't want to violate a professional standard. You want to be very careful. But ask yourself again who your audience is. And the next thing I'd like to address is, Chad, I think you addressed the commission in Port Angeles. And a report I got said that you advised the commission that the meetings were ill-attended and were contentious. I agree with that. Okay. Here's my point. Whether they're well-attended or not depends on whether there is something for the public to get value out of by coming here. That is controlled 100% by the department. Then, whether they're contentious or not depends on the way you run the meeting once the people arrive. So I would prefer in the future, when you're speaking to the commission, that you not point fingers at us, but you look in the mirror in the morning. Thank you.
Marsh? Art Holman Sports. Fish and Wildlife has manipulated this policy for its failure. When it started out, sports had priority on the Kings, and the commercials had priority on the Silvers. Now we have no priority. They were supposed to enhance our fishery, and they ruined it. When you take a 14% mortality and you replace it with 56% mortality, it's going to fail. And they know it. That's why they come up with all this stuff. It's time that we start taking our fishery back. If anything else, take it out of Fish and Wildlife, put it in the sports, at least we'll have fish then. Thank you.
Ross Barker, South Bend. I'd just like to say that, reiterate that, that the study we saw tonight was well done within its parameters, but it does not address adequately the effect of the policy. It doesn't look at the externalities, and it can be misleading. As several people have said, it's not really very useful to decision makers. One gets the impression that it's designed to say, look, we've made all these sacrifices, and the wild fish didn't get anything out of it, so we need to dump the policy. That's the impression that you get. I have a way of figuring out the difference between, if you're saying there's a difference in wild fish experience in the bay and then in the rivers or at the hatchery, call me. I have a way to do that. But I think the advisory process has really deteriorated. I think that we're speaking through a filter. That's not what we want to hear tonight. Some other time. It's been over a year. I submitted pages of comments on the policy. I've never got a response to a single one of them. And I think that the Region 6 Fish Department is isolated from its customers, commercial and sports.
Marlisa Williams-Dugan. My comment to the commission is that after reviewing the report, nicely presented by the members of the staff, that it is incomplete in its analysis to bring in broader ramifications of things that created the smaller than expected increase in wild fish escapement to the gravel. And I would heartily recommend that we are seriously looking at least 4 more years and possibly 8 with the policy without tinkering and with an absolute 14% escapement on impacts moving forward. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you all for coming.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm Bob Wick, and I'm going to speak as a normal citizen here. But I've got some real concerns about the snagging that's been going on and also the taking eggs. There was a couple people arrested down on an A cell last year that had, I think, 4.5 to 5 buckets full of Chinook eggs. And I would like to know what happened to those people. We never see the outcome of it. But if those fish are permitted to get by, we sure as hell ought to protect them in the freshwater, because that's where those eggs was taken at. And I think enforcement really needs to stand up. And if you want to cut the thing down to 14%, I think we ought to shut all the freshwater fisheries down to protect the salmon once they get there. That makes a hell of a lot of sense, because that's the only place they're going to spawn is in the freshwater. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, everybody, for coming. Appreciate it. Moving towards the door.